This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Much of the recent news from Iraq focuses on the hotspots, Najaf, Fallujah, and Baghdad's Sadr City. The news we hear is often not good. Clashes between American forces and Shiite militants continue. The Iraqi police and the Iraqi army are increasingly involved. An interim government struggles to establish some kind of control and legitimacy, while basic services remain in short supply. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to talk about these stories as they're perceived by Iraqi citizens. If you have questions about life on the ground in Iraq, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is NPR's Anne Garrell. She just returned from her most recent trip to Iraq. During that time, she traveled to some places we don't hear often about. She joins us now from her home in northwestern Connecticut. Annie, good to have you back on the program.
It's great to be home.
I bet it is. Where did you go on this last trip besides Baghdad?
Well, as you can imagine, travel is difficult because of kidnappings and the security challenges directed largely against foreigners. But I did go to Najaf and Karbala. I did go out into villages in the south. Now, that's in the Shiite area. I went north of Baghdad as well to a place called Bakuba and Balad Ruz. Now, this is in the Sunni triangle. These areas have seen their share of violence. But it was possible to go there. It's nothing like as bad, say, as Fallujah, where foreigners simply cannot go. They have been told by the residents there, do not go there or you will be kidnapped or worse.
Even so, Fallujah aside, those fears have to be ever present.
Yes, absolutely. And, I mean, in Najaf, curiously, I mean, especially since now it's erupted again, it was not that bad when I was there. I was able to go around the streets and certainly in the villages. But in the Shiite communities, the Sunni communities north of Baghdad, I wouldn't sort of do man on the street. I didn't hang around the streets. I went and saw people I knew about, you know, or went into shops. I didn't make myself as visible as I might have.
Going back to maybe the old days in Afghanistan under the Taliban, women journalists in particular had to go in wearing protective clothing, as it were. Did you resort to that in some of the areas of Iraq we're told are becoming increasingly under the influence of fundamentalists?
Absolutely, especially in the Shiite communities, I would wear an abaya, which is basically a black shroud that hangs from your head all the way down. It's extremely hot. But that is, everyone in the villages wears that. It is really a token of respect. Now, frankly, I'm lucky as a woman because this is very much protective coloring. When I sit in the car in an abaya or, a black scarf, I am not very noticeable. Male journalists have a much more difficult time sort of keeping a low profile, if you will.
Obviously, much of the coverage focuses on injuries and casualties and the deaths of American soldiers and other members of the U.S.-led forces. We forget that so many casualties have been caused to Iraqi police. I think there was another bombing today in which 7 Iraqi policemen were killed. As you go around to some of these smaller places, how are the small-town police forces responding?
Well, it varies. Let me just say, after sovereignty, at the end of June, American troops began to pull back in many of the towns in the Sunni Triangle north of Baghdad. They started keeping a much lower profile and pushing the Iraqi police and the Iraqi National Guard up front, and it appeared to be working. And this was true in Baghdad as well, it was also true in these smaller towns. And Iraqis responded very well to this. They wanted to see their own people patrolling the streets, taking care. And indeed, in some instances when there have been attacks on the police stations lately, 2 months ago you would hear people in these towns blame the United States immediately and say it was their fault. And the police would blame the United States. Everybody blamed the United States, even though, you know, it wasn't the U.S. who was doing the attacks. But they would say that they had seen American helicopters, you know, hitting the police station. Just the most extraordinary tales would emerge. And this fiction would become fact in everybody's minds. But now I was hearing very different things. People were increasingly angry at the insurgents because in many ways they'd lost part of their raison d'etre of fighting the occupation. The troops weren't as present, but the big issue for these people was not only were, you know, Iraqis being killed, Iraqi policemen, but they had seen none of the promised reconstruction. And so jobs is key, and it's one reason why when Secretary of State Powell was recently there, he talked about, you know, the one thing he talked about was speeding up the dispersal of the $18 billion in aid so that there will be more jobs. There's only been about $500 million has been dispersed so far, and, you know, people need jobs.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. We're again talking with NPR's Ann Garrels, just back after another tour in Baghdad. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address, totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Ben, who's with us from Arlington, Virginia.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
First, great show. Second, Ann, I don't think there's any public radio listener who doesn't admire you greatly. And third, my question is, Ms. Garrels, how would you say that the attitude of U.S. troops towards American journalists has changed over the course of time that you've been involved in the U.S. conflict in Iraq? I will take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
It's hard to generalize about attitudes. I mean, in some instances, you know, we have not had a good relationship with the troops. They're jittery. They've seen camera crews or even me with a radio microphone. And from afar, they've interpreted this as a potential weapon. And in some cases, journalists have been shot and killed. Generally speaking, I've had actually a very good relationship with the military, and I've found them to be, in fact, incredibly helpful. I've been on a few embedded excursions with the troops, and they've been very open and very forthcoming about the issues, far more so, frankly, than American civilian officials.
Let's get another caller in, and this is Cynthia. Cynthia's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes. My son is in Mosul, and I just wanted to comment on the fact that most of the reporting seems to be coming, as you said, Ms. Garrels, from the larger areas. But I just want people to know that just because they're not hearing of constant action in other areas, it doesn't mean that our troops are not being engaged. My son is an infantry medic, and he's been engaged regularly in Mosul, and you just don't hear a lot about it. And I've had several people comment that, oh, your son's in Mosul, so he's safe, he's fine, and he gets engaged regularly. So I think people need to realize that you're not getting the entire story from over there.
Well, that's right, and unfortunately, our ability to travel has been, as I noted earlier, not stopped, but definitely limited. It is just so dangerous. And it's not just for my own personal safety, but for you know, the Iraqis who work with me. And you're right about Mosul. Once upon a time, it was considered one of the safer places, but that is no longer the case.
Isn't that where Saddam's sons were found?
That's right. But lately, there have been a number of car bomb attacks. Churches were attacked there recently. They're pretty constant insurgent attacks on a variety of targets there, including against local officials.
Yes, and when my son's unit, the Striker Brigade, took over the 101st up there, they replaced 20,000 soldiers with only 5,000 soldiers. So we have many less American troops patrolling the same areas that you know, four times as many were patrolling before. So I just wanted to make that comment that all our soldiers over there are in harm's way and doing a fabulous job for us.
And if they're in the Striker Brigade, aren't they using those new lighter weight armored vehicles, smaller and less safe perhaps than tanks?
Well, they're a little less safe than tanks, but they're much more maneuverable, so you have an increased safety factor there. But see, that not all of the soldiers in the Stryker brigades are actually in Strykers. My son happens to be in a foot patrol unit. He works in the middle of Mosul, and they go out in Humvees and on foot, house-to-house searches. So, you know, they are you know, just around the corner any minute from engaging fire. And so, like I said, it's real tough for all of them over there.
Cynthia, we wish your son the best.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call. We're talking with NPR's Ann Garrels from Baghdad, just back from Baghdad. Sorry to scare you there for a second, Annie. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here are some of the stories NPR is following this afternoon. Salem Chalabi, the head of special tribunal in charge of trying Saddam Hussein, is facing murder charges himself. And a pending ballot measure in California would funnel billions of dollars into embryonic stem cell research. President Bush restricted funding for such research 3 years ago. You can hear more on that story and an interview with Salem Chalabi coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News. And Annie, I guess I have to ask you about this. All of this broke after you left Iraq, but Salem Chalabi and his uncle Ahmed Chalabi, previously the favorite of many in the Pentagon, now both under indictment.
Yes, it was not so surprising, perhaps, in the case of Ahmed Chalabi. He's had a checkered past. But for Salem Chalabi, this was, I think everybody was taken very much by surprise by the allegations. And we're all waiting to find out more. He is accused of being behind, at the very least, a murder of a member of the finance ministry, apparently, who was investigating the Chalabi family.
Another story that's erupted, I guess, just as you were leaving and has gotten worse since, is the renewed fighting between the Mahdi army, the people loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite firebrand, as he's generally called. Were you able to probe people's feelings towards him and about him and his forces?
Yes. I was down in Najaf and in the villages around there for quite some time. The people I spoke to, certainly, I mean, the middle class, the villagers, there was no enormous sympathy for Muqtada Sadr, though they do have enormous reverence for his father, who was killed, who was a beloved Ayatollah, a very charismatic Ayatollah who was killed by Saddam Hussein. So they don't dismiss Sadr altogether because he is the son of this much-beloved figure, but they thought that he was creating a lot of trouble. They thought that it should be negotiated, and they didn't think that the U.S. should go in and shoot. But Sadr increasingly didn't keep his word on any deal that he made. Mm-hmm. Most of his supporters come from urban areas. There are a lot of sort of criminal elements. I mean, that I've come across in his groups, they're real thugs in many ways. They're quite sort of they tell everybody what to do. They brook no dissent, and increasingly the people I've found were either disgusted with them or terrified of them, and in some cases unwilling even to discuss them because they were afraid of repercussions.
Here's an email question from Susan in Marble Rock, Iowa. Clearly a reader of Ann Garrel's book about Baghdad before the war called Naked in Baghdad. She asks, how is Amr and did he rejoin the army?
Amr is, I'd say, is sort of as dispirited as is pretty much all Iraqis. He comes from the Sunni triangle. He wants the United States to leave Iraq now. Many Iraqi, and he actually feels very, very, very much that. And he always looks at me and sort of says, "You're not going to hate me for saying this, are you?" But I mean, and it's something you hear, you know, across the board for many Iraqis, you know, the U.S. should leave. But then you say, should they leave now? And most of them say, oh, God forbid, not now, because we're going to have a civil war. I mean, that's the ongoing conversation there.
Ann Garrels, as always, thank you very much.
And thank
great,
you.
Great to talk to you back when you're home.
Thanks.
NPR foreign correspondent Anne Garrow spoke to us from her home in Connecticut. She's the author, as I mentioned, of the book Naked in Baghdad, the Iraq War, as seen by NPR's correspondent Anne Garrow. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.